How's it? Otherwise You Well. Welcome to another episode of Otherwise You Well, a comics approach to wellness. It is not a mental health solution. It is not a prescriptive way to live your life. All we're doing here is asking, we're trying to just answer one question. How do you know how you are if you don't know who you are? I've invited a couple of some interesting people. Just to figure out how they go about knowing who they are or not knowing who they are and what their kind of journey is. We use some ridiculous personality tests. We'll go through the Wheel of Feels just now. And this was quite a kismet situation, how I met this next guest. We met at a coffee shop. I wasn't even supposed to be there that day. And I think they recognized me or something and asked me a question, and one thing led to another, and this person is not only a traditional healer, also a mental health activist, also a playwright. I just want to make sure that I greet you correctly, and you can teach me if I'm wrong.
Sure.
Ladies and gentlemen, and however else you identify, Sango Manene.
Togoza.
Togoza Gogo. Nice to have you here.
Nice to meet you.
So can we explain to people why we do that? Why that's the greeting? If you're not familiar with how to greet a South African traditional healer, Sangoma, why do we say that? Because we're giving thanks, right?
Yeah, we're actually saying be happy. Togoza, ukthokoza is to be joyful.
To be joyful.
And when you greet a sangoma, you are greeting the entourage or the souls that walk with them.
Mm-hmm.
So you are more or less in advance saying, you know, be happy with me, be joyful.
Okay.
And the reason we clap hands is because we don't traditionally have contact.
Right.
So it is a way of acknowledging, but without the hugs or the shakes or the physical.
Wonderful. Mm. I love that so much. And, you know, I often wonder if when I do see somebody, you know, often you'll find sangomas that are a barista at a coffee shop or whatever. And I never know if I'm overstepping, if I do greet appropriately, or do I ask, do I say, you know, what's the protocol in that environment? Do I ask, like, are you a sangoma, or do I just greet automatically, or how do I go about doing this? You know,
I think intuitively, mm-hmm. you know, if you sense that you are, you know, the person is walking with ancestors or souls that you want to greet in that way, it's not an offensive greeting. So
okay.
if somebody's not a sangoma and you greet them like that, actually I think they are pleasantly surprised and they like it. So take the chance of doing that greeting even if you're not sure. But asking them is also not a problem, I don't think, but some people might have very negative connotations to sangomas. As we know, they've been stigmatized in the past. So if you say, are you a sangoma, they're going to start thinking, you know, that's not of my belief system, or that's not of me. Why is that person calling me or suggesting that I might have that appearance?
Right. Are there any markers that people can identify? I mean, you know, I often see people wearing different types of beads. Are there ways that we can recognize a sangoma, like in the street? Is there something that we can identify with?
Yeah, typically the dress code is a big part of it. Although these days it's become, you know, a lifestyle and a fashion and a trend that most, not all of the people that dress like sangomas are actually sangomas. So it's difficult these days to tell. But yeah, the beads, not just sangomas, by the way. I mean, spiritually ascended or spiritually cultured people usually have a very different look about them. And with sangomas, it's the black, red, and white, and the leopard prints that you might look for, and the beads are the red and white beads, the white beads. Sometimes it's yellow beads and black beads. It depends on the ranking of the sangoma, and sometimes it's the leopard print, whether it's skins or just a cloth that's printed that way. The hair is usually, although that doesn't actually count these days, people who are sangomas will wear weaves and all kinds of things, but usually the dreadlocks and the just natural hair with maybe beads in the hair. And if they are really being authentic and traditional, they might wear gallbladders on their hair, on their the crown of their heads or the back of their heads. If they are at the stage of being an initiate, not yet a full sangoma, you'll see them wearing either the red clay all over their bodies. That means they're at a stage of detox, and they're at a stage of initial stages of initiation and becoming. And then you might also see them wearing white clay all over their body, as well as wearing, you know, reds and blacks. And some will carry the traditional ishoba, which is the horse tail, or the, it's like a black tail thing with a stick at the end. That's like a witch's wand for sangomas. Mm. And they may also, you know, carry a shield with them if they are being very traditional, or if you find them in a ceremonial setting. Yeah, they are varied, but there is a sort of a standard look
for that kind of thing. But there are also other significations of beads. Somebody explained to me that red and white beads on a man, I'm not sure if it's on a woman, but can mean that they lost their father or their, is that true? Am I pulling information out of thin air, or did someone want, because, you know, sometimes also people gaslight you and just tell you stuff, you know, is that incorrect?
Yes. From my, you know, knowing and experience of tradition, men don't wear beads just because they've lost a wife or a husband. Mm. Beads are essentially a new thing, actually, to Zulu society. It's a fashion that started in the 1800s when Shaka started trading with Europeans. Mm. They brought beads. And so it was, at first, it was a sign of royalty, like, you know, you would find pearls in Europe, but then it filtered down to common man. So the colors and the symbology that you see today is not really, you know, traditional.
Right.
Mostly it is the dress of a sangoma is marked by very natural things. So it is also marked by the actual stages. And the traditional way is obviously each rite of passage is marked by a particular sacrifice of an animal. It's either black or white goats or cattle. And so the skin of that animal, you keep it and you wear it as part of acknowledging that animal kind of assisted your passage to the next stage of passage. So, you know, before it was mostly skins and things, that materials that were relevant to the actual phase of growth or initiation that you're in. And then as fashion comes about, as things change, you know, the red and white beads became a thing that symbolized them, sangomas, and the putting beads in the hair, as opposed to just being a wild cat
right.
from the bush, became a thing. And now, you know, sangomas have long, you know, nails and whatever else.
Our fashionistas.
And they, you know, they cut their cloth now to walk the red carpets and use the same cloths. But these cloths are essentially from, I think, Singapore, China, India. They have nothing to do with us, really.
It's crazy. It's crazy how, we can assign meaning to things and how that can shift and how quickly things are shifting and how we're all sort of learning at the same time. And you know, being a public person, for me, I'm learning during the people at the same time. So yeah. I often get a lot of flack because I'm on the front lines of the learning. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've got to take the hits of ignorance. And that's something I think that's so beautiful to kind of just go, hey, listen, you're allowed to not know stuff. You're allowed to ask. You know, I think that that's something that's missing from our society at the moment because of cancel culture. People are so terrified of being wrong, but not seeing that there's this gap where you can go, hi, can you explain this to me? So there's like this conversation of a mute society that I speak about because people are so afraid, particularly white people are afraid of saying anything in case they're wrong. And, you know, are they doing cultural appropriate? Just ask. If you don't know, just ask. It's okay to not know. You don't know. We are living in a society that has legacies of apartheid and social algorithms that separate you from information. I call it the apartheid algorithm on television, where, you know, we still have your SABC 1, SABC 2, SABC 3, ETV. Even with the new broadcasters that go, okay, well, this channel only, you know, does this language and this channel does that language. And as a result of language, we're not exposed to the same media. So we're not exposed to the same information. So unless you are now watching The Wife as a middle-aged white woman that lives in Melrose, how would you know about taxi violence politics, you know, unless you immerse yourself and take yourself out of your algorithm and into that space? Which is why I just feel that people need to be okay with not knowing, okay with being a little bit ignorant, but then not be arrogant about your ignorance. I think there's a lot of colonial heritage of, you know, I must be right. I must never lose status. I must, you know, and then entitlement in each person's individual culture. So I just want to tell people, and that's just coming from me, just ask, you know, just ask. I mean, see how easy that was. See how easy that was where I didn't know and I just asked. And were you offended by me asking?
No, and it's interesting that you speak of the silent European community. It's interesting to me that that's how it's become. Mm. Because for us, for the world at large to actually get to know some of the cultures, some of the practices of Sangomas, for instance, or other traditional things, it's thanks to a lot of European anthropologists who were very liberal in their philosophy or their politics, and who took the opportunity, the chance, to in a context of a Eurocentric society that wasn't necessarily promoting traditional African culture in any way. You did find certain scholars and academics and researchers who took the time, who were European and took the time to delve into indigenous culture and indigenous practices and customs, who told the world, who wrote books about, you know, I can't think of any right now that I write this second, but I think we know about them, that our coffee tables, you know, were burdened with some of those pictures, some of those stories about the Maasai, stories about, you know, Sangoma, stories about all kinds of other crafts and indigenous knowledge and things. And so you could say that at some point, at a time when African or Black society was shut down through colonialism or through other means, that there were the voices of Europeans that took the torch forward to still make a presentation that these societies are not dead, these civilizations are still very much alive, or they do have integrity behind their philosophies or their way of life or their lifestyles. I don't know who the founder of National Geographic is, but you know, those are some right. of the people that we, you know, we paid tribute to when we remember that at some point our voice was very much shut down.
Right.
But there were those few, and they were European.
Mm.
So I think, you know, white or Eurocentric culture and people should remember that it is within their DNA to have a knowing, because ultimately I think the whole sort of color coding is a very fake imposition on humans.
Mm.
And we have a curiosity about each other. And I have a curiosity about Koreans and the Aboriginal American people. I've noticed in small provincial societies in South Africa, in KZN, for example, there's been a long-standing, fascinating fascination with the martial arts, with Chinese and martial culture, you know, where they're always mimicking Chinese people and saying those, you know, there's a fascination among humans about our cultures, and it is not limited to just your own culture that one should express and be interested, or we have a right to comment and to express ourselves as Europeans if we're Africans, as Africans if we're Europeans, or you know, as Oriental if we're African. There are very much interlinked links and webs that link us that are hidden. Some of them are in our DNA, and you can't identify yourself as just what appears on the surface, because beneath the surface is the whole universe.
That's so beautiful. I want to delve into so many tangents off the back of that. You said so many things. What I remember going into, so the traditional Serbian dance is called the kolo. So a kolo is, well, there's different versions of it, but there's one specific dance that we do. And it's very similar to like Greek dancing, but we've got our traditional dress. And, you know, some are integrated men and women dancing together. Other dances, you'll have all the women will do one part and all the men will do other parts. And then they join together. And if you listen to the type of instruments, so we use a lot of the accordion in our dances, and drums and accordion. But if you look at Pedi traditional dancing, it's very similar to Serbian traditional dancing. So here are two indigenous groups on different parts of the world that have got this very similar rhythm pattern to their dance, to their history. And you'll find that in other spaces as well. So obviously with the martial arts, I did karate for many years and was completely thrown into that. I've got my first dan in, I've got a black belt. I was completely obsessed with that at some stage of my life, and just the tenets of discipline and how similar that is. And that now that you're saying that, I realize that goes into a lot of like KZN roots of, you know, refrain from violent behavior. Integrity, discipline, character, but refrain from violent behavior. Know it, but don't go and munikaksukni. don't go and look for a fight, but know that you can defend yourself in a situation. And I think any sort of discipline is worth investigating, because there's, you know, there's structure behind a discipline. There's, you know, rituals. There's, and, you know, with Serbian culture, and a lot of it is based on, well, and a lot of the defense of the culture in more recent times, is in defense of its religion, not necessarily geography. So former Yugoslavia, you know, there's Croatia, Serbia, Albania, like all the Czechoslovakia, like all of these places, I stand to be corrected. But a Serb identifies by virtue of its religion as well as its area. So we were Serbian Orthodox, whereas the Croats are Roman Catholic. So it had different... but then prior to that, there was the Ottoman Empire, which was a 400-year oppression of a different type of religion. So a lot of the practices and the rituals are quite similar. So we have a saint that looks after our family. So we've inherited Sveti Dimitri, who's a Saint Dimitri. It was our saint day the other day. And then once a year, you offer wheat to the saint that needs to be blessed by your community priest, and that is shared first by the first male of the family, the leader of the male that carries the gene, and then it is passed on to each in the hierarchical kind of setting, and that is to ask for blessings for our crops for the year, for our family to be protected, and then you inherit your saint into your family. So it's an ancestor essentially that protects your family, and there's a sacrifice and there's an offering. So these kinds of themes live in different communities and in different cultures. And what I found the most interesting about Korea is that the country is split into Roman Catholic and Buddhist, but has also inherited the Chinese Confucianism. So they've got like these three kind of thinkings that are blended, but we have that here as well, where there's a lot of the conflict comes from different schools of thought, you know, so the Buddhist community, and yet, this is what's quite interesting, a funeral ritual crosses all boundaries. So you'll have Catholic people doing a Korean funeral ritual, but a lot of those are very sort of Buddhist kind of symbolisms, even similar to quite Hindu rituals, you know, where offerings of fruit and offerings of different types of grains that you'll do at a funeral. I've been through down a lot of different religious lanes in my life.
I mean, rest assured, they all, which is why they have such similarities, they all hark back to the original star system where we came from. And in that setting, we did have the Lemurian, the god-goddess, or the divine flame pair. And our spiritual connections at that time and our practices were very much what we're practicing today. The only difference maybe today is that there's been interjections with other species, and other species have brought in their own agenda or their own sort of doctrines or practices, sciences and technologies. And so in our interaction, not only have we changed doctrines and belief systems and practices and ritual, we've also changed genetics, because at that point of interaction with other species, there has been a genetic shift in our DNA, and it is therefore the central conflict and the central duality in all of us now is the memory of Lemuria or the star system, and what that was, and our spiritual connections and our gifts and abilities at that time, which basically were freedom of universal connection, and also the gifts and abilities that were not based on technology or science that connected us to everything, and the sort of eternal love and the utopia that was there was interrupted. And in that interruption, we are now having to fight division. And now there's so-called original sin. Now there's the other genetics and the other cultures and other sciences. that have come into that. And that has nothing to do with white race or black race or Chinese race, or it has to do with the original Lemurians. They are in Greece and Croatia and Serbia and Russia and Tibet and South America, North America. But you cannot visually see them. You connect through the soul with them. Hence, you will connect to a soul group. You'll connect to an individual who's from Tibet, and you know that you have known each other before. Mm. You don't have to share the same cultures or the same language, but your souls have this origin that is of that first origin, where we were before the dimming down of that light. And so essentially now we are kind of battling to return to that state of being light beings. And there are too many interruptions, corruptions, interferences that are alien to our own makeup, are alien to our own DNA, that we've become preoccupied with getting the illness out of ourselves and getting the disease out of ourselves, and the disease being a genetic one. That is the ultimate challenge now in this existence, is really wading through all of your genetic pool and your lineages and your ancestry, and trying to harmonize in the presence of something alien within us. And some of the things that you speak of, such as the integration of religion. Religion is not a spiritual construct, and therefore that's another thing that becomes a jacket that you have to wear in order to fit in society, but it actually is cumbersome on your soul, because it is a construct. It's not a spiritual or a soul centered way of life. And then within the context of our trying to be and become and be conscious, there's then the aspect of science, which is another whole aspect that makes everything clinical and removes the soul and the spiritual, and is not holistic in any way. So that you now are in a world and a way of living where you must separate aspects of yourself. Your spiritual must go into the clinic of the church, and your physical must now go into the clinic of science, hospital, and the soul, still in the new modern context, doesn't have an institution that truly serves the soul in the way that would benefit the soul. And what happens then is that it is very much an individual journey that people have to take for themselves, and not necessarily to buy into this three aspects, these three religions, categories, and trying to make them fit, but actually to break away from them and only access the soul connection, because the soul is what connects to the universe. The soul is what connects to the DNA within the bloodlines, and the soul is what is able to access all of the records within your cell that are necessary in order to inform you of your destiny. And everything else that is commercial or science or religion is a construct primarily to to serve a sort of a human construct, and it may not be purely human. There may be other species involved, but it's very much a construct for the purposes of a certain agenda, is the only way I can put it. That is not necessarily about elevating consciousness. It's not necessarily about centering ourselves in our universal purpose. In fact, it sort of moves us very much away from that and has us looking at ourselves, each other, in categories of color, in categories of intelligence, in categories of, you know, career, in categories of financial wealth, and so on. Is very much a material life that is now deprived of soul, and that has become so clinical that most people are having a real struggle to find themselves, because they identify themselves as this construct.
Where is Lemuria?
I was hoping you weren't going to ask me the galactic questions.
Yeah, okay.
Where is this place?
Who is running the agenda?
Yeah.
I mean, we can go into that. Do you want to go into that?
Where, I don't know. I will ask you, because all of the information you'll be asking me is within yourself and me and, you know, the next person.
Well, we can do a follow-up on that. We can do a follow-up on that, because, I mean, I feel like that needs its own episode. I want to go into something lighthearted. I want to go into... do you watch K-dramas?
Yeah, I love them. my favorite of all time is Marriage Contract.
Oh, really?
It's a rom-com, and it's a series, and it is just...
I actually haven't watched Marriage Contract.
Marriage Contract.
I've watched about 100 different K-dramas, but I've never watched it.
It's about this Korean man who's wealthy. You know, he's the heir to, you know, the wealth.
Chibol.
Yes. Yeah. And literally the series opens where he just lets go of a girlfriend. And he bumps into this young woman who's single mother.
Right.
The epitome of what I think Koreans just look down upon, because she's not only a single mother, she's dying of cancer. Mm. And so she's really struggling, right? And he meets her and at first just thinks that she's out for his money.
Right.
And they have this misunderstanding. And then, you know, through many, many different encounters, it becomes the most incredible romantic series.
I have seen this.
Where he is now so invested in her sort of going towards her death, basically.
Right.
And it doesn't even try to keep her alive.
Right.
He has to just make the best of their love and the best of their relationship that they possibly can before she passes. And their kid, this little 5-year-old, is the most incredible actress and is endearing and just steals his heart, basically. So it is about this love that forms just at the end of one of them's lives. I'm obsessed with twin flame relationships. So
yeah, a twin flame, and, you know, yeah, exactly. I love all the different types of K-dramas. What I like is I like the ones with the 300-year-old deity who has come back to finish a soul contract, but he's actually, he's come back to life. Or there's a lot of like reincarnation stories. Mm. There's Alchemy of Souls is the one that got me into all of the, like, Alchemy of Souls is my absolute favorite. I'm like, E.J. Wook is my heartthrob. but, you know, the concept that you can, you know, take over someone else's body through the soul, and that, you know, people can't identify whether you can. And, you know, also the fact that there's this like female lead that is just a fighting machine. But and how that is then encapsulated by another actress in the next season, and you know that you, the writers have crafted it so beautifully that you still see the same character, and the performances are so powerful that you still see the same character even though it's a different actress. And it's, you know,
wait a minute, I think I did see that one, the one, or maybe not, it's there's one where I forget the title, but the woman is married, she's very, very overweight, and she is like just a slave in this she's a makoti who married into this family, but they married, or the man, as it unfolds, married her because of her money and because of her access to land.
Right,
and he made a decision that he was going to marry her for that, but then he kills her, or he attempts to kill her. But she doesn't die, but he doesn't know that she's not dead. And she decides to get, like, he throws her off a cliff into a huge lake, and she comes out of that and goes for surgery, like a whole plastic surgery.
Oh,
and comes back looking
a million dollar woman. I haven't seen
comes
that
back,
one. Yes.
I won't spoil it for
yeah,
you.
Yeah, okay.
But comes
thank
back
you.
Like the most beautiful woman on earth, and actually the woman then gets back to
okay you've given me something to watch, because I mean my entire algorithm is just K-dramas, and
yes,
that what I like about them is it's like a 16 part series, it's 1.5 hours per episode.
Yeah,
you just get caught up in it, and I live alone, I don't have a partner and I spend my nights watching K-dramas, and it makes me so happy.
Yeah.
And yeah, as I said, there's the ones with the CEO and the secretary.
Yeah.
There's the ones with the more fantasy ones with the reincarnation.
Yes.
There's the medical ones. There's the crime dramas. I just watched one called Partners for Justice, which is kind of, it's the Sherlock Holmes house format. You know, there's the troubled scientist who is grumpy, and like his Watson character, who is, you know, from a different department, but they work together to figure things out, and only he can figure it out because he's the troubled genius. Mm. And
for me, it's almost like when I watch them, I'm literally watching my past life. Like I'm watching myself, or watching people that I interact with. I have a sense of that there's definitely a deeper connection than just, you know, the surface.
As we're speaking. Ooh, it's so hectic. When I got to Korea, the day I landed, I felt that same feeling twice. Well, once, one other time in my life, when I the first time I'd gone to the Eastern Cape, when we were sort of driving through, and you know, Transkei and the mountains, and as I was driving through there, I was like, "Whoa, okay, hi, guys." How's it? I could feel, like, I literally felt those mountains. I felt such a phenomenal sensation. It was like it felt like my DNA was activated. And I felt the same feeling when I landed in Seoul.
Korea,
I felt I've been here before. I know these people. Even like my Korean friends are like my palate, like the way that I, the food I like, the way that food is processed. So what was interesting for me, I think I've said this on another podcast interview, so if you've heard this story before, forgive me. I came to a horrible realization at some point, the concept of being, you know, the concept of privilege of being, actually, I don't even want to get into this. Basically, like, the people are nice to me because I'm white, right? In South Africa. I don't like that. I don't like being given anything unfairly. In some communities, in other communities, because I'm white, I'm treated badly, you know? So it's a double-edged sword. But for the most part, Koreans are incredibly xenophobic. Incredibly xenophobic. They've got a very sort of, they think they're the best Asians. And cannot stand white people. And they cannot stand any other people. And of the white people, they don't like tanned white people. So I'm like they're worst. Like they can't, I'm the worst category. So I went to go visit a friend of mine, and then I went back to visit her a second time. And she had lived, you know, the little corner store. There's a corner store everywhere. 24-hour convenience stores, it's like the best thing. There's one on every corner and you can get absolutely anything. It's like, those are my favorite things, just the convenience stores. And there's this little old man, and he always gave me like a free banana milk. I was expecting the same experience that this friend of mine was experiencing. I wanted to know what the feeling of prejudice, of being othered negatively, felt like holistically. So, okay, cool. You're going to be seen as this white person and people are going to hate you. I wanted to know what prejudice felt like on a mass scale, because I had experienced pockets of that here, but not predominantly. If anything, there was a fetishization that I heartbrokenly realized later that was what I was experiencing. So I wanted to know what the other side of that feeling was, because my friend said that, you know, she'd been there for 4 years and that she'd only experienced so much hatred and negativity and prejudice. Even though she followed customs, you know, 안녕하세요, 감사합니다, 네, you know, following how people would greet and, you know, bowing and when you're supposed to bow and how you're supposed. It's very similar to us. You know, you don't just give with one hand. You don't just take with one hand. You know, how very similar to all of our cultures. And I was just myself. Same attitude, same way that I treat people. I was the same me in that space. And I was only met with kindness, with love, with respect, with fascination. There was only one time when I was on a train where someone poked me. Apparently like old Korean women, like poke or pull your hair or things like that. I experienced that. I didn't know who it was because it was very crowded. But this man at the corner store, turns out he spoke English the whole time. He never spoke English to my friend. He lived in San Francisco for like 25 years. His name is Jeff. And, you know, he greeted me. I came back and I, you know, came to see him the second time. He's like, oh, I've been wondering how you are. And I realized that personally, Nina, my light is going to shine wherever I am. And it allowed me to feel less resentful or curious or whatever the thing was about, you know, maybe people only spoke to me because I was white, or maybe people were only mean to me because I was white. And it actually helped me remove all of my guilt, fear, or whatever it was that I was attaching to this thing of just being racialized. Mm. And I realized that I'm just me, and that my energy is just mine. And when I'm in my absolute pure authentic self and I meet someone else and they're pure authentic self and I just see you where you're at and respect you for what you are, I'm just going to be met with another human being. And I didn't experience any negativity.
Yeah.
So, you know, it made me feel much better. I felt relieved.
Yeah. Sometimes also, you know, I at some point in my travels, and I've traveled a lot since I was a child, I matured, about why it is that I traveled so much at some point. It was especially after I went through the Sangoma initiations, in that I started to realize that I was, some of these travels, I was actually repatriating certain ancestors back to their original places. Mm, mm. And for instance, I started to look back at, I went to France after school, after graduating from high school.
Where did you stay?
And I went to Paris, and that's where I went to Alliance Française. And then on the side, I was in a fille au pair. I was about 17 and I left when I was about 19. When I was analyzing my travels retrospectively, I realized, for instance, I have Sarah Bartman as my sole group. And it came to me, when it came to me, I was living in Canada, and it came to me in a long, elaborate dream that was teaching me about the damage, the soul matrix damage to the structure of the female or the goddess. And it was demonstrated in the dream through her body. And when I started to research into why I had that dream, I came across the book and then the documentary about her. And then I looked back at my trip in Paris. I wasn't sold off to like an entertainer you know, I didn't go through, you know, those things, but I did a lot at 18, 19. There was not a single night I wasn't in a nightclub.
That's what 18 and 19 are for, right?
Yeah, right. And then I also, the high school that I graduated from was Ethiopia.
And oh, interesting.
Yeah, I had my family decided to migrate to Ethiopia in, it was 1983, which is 78 Ethiopian year. And I went to...
Oh, of course, they're on the Julian calendar. Yeah. Right.
So I went to a very missionary all-girls school there. And, you know, of course, it wasn't my choice to go to Ethiopia. It was my stepfather had decided that he wanted to move there to study the system that Ethiopia had moved from an imperialist state to a socialist state. And he was a communist, so he wanted to...
Really?
Yes, he wanted to. He was a white South African, Durban born. And
sure, that's so interesting to be a communist who wants to instill socialism in an orthodox religion. Were they not a monarchy?
They were. Haile Selassie was the emperor.
Right, right.
And he was overthrown, hence Mengistu, Mengistu Haile Mariam, I think his name is. Yeah, he's living in Zim, exiled now. But he took over at the time with the Communist Party in
what in that was Ethiopia. This post World War II?
Oh yeah, it was just in the '80s.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Of course, because World War II, Ethiopia was part of the Allied forces, so a lot of the anyone that was sort of had to go through exile or was leaving Europe or. I think went through either South Africa or Ethiopia prior to going to like London.
Well,
a lot of the people that were being expatriated from
Rastafari
Europe.
Or Haile Selassie was Pan-Africanist, and he set up the Organization of African Union, which is now the African Union, and so the headquarters for the unification of Africa was centered in Ethiopia. And actually in the 80s, the early 80s, that was still there. And some of the South Africans that we met there, who were family friends, who became family friends, were working for the OAU.
Right.
And some of them came from Botswana, some of them came from South Africa, some from Namibia and Swaziland. But yeah, the Ethiopia has been one of the unifying countries, at least according to the philosophy of Haile Selassie. but it's a forgotten, you know, that's been forgotten, and it was one of the places. It is the only country that's never been colonized in the whole of Africa. The Italians tried it, and they had war with them for about 5 years.
Right, when Mussolini's vibe.
Yes, but they just ended up staying in Ethiopia and becoming Ethiopians, essentially, and taking on, you know, Ethiopian culture and stuff. So there's a lot of Italians in Ethiopia. And they've recently been able to separate Asmara into its own. It was a province of Ethiopia at one point, and just in the 90s, I think it gained an independence. And then Djibouti was taken over by the French. Not taken over, but it's sort of just it's become like a colony, a little colony of, right. of French people. But the rest of it pretty much is ancient. I mean, Addis Ababa as a city is the most surreal African. If you imagine Africa in your wildest romantic imaginations of what Africa must have looked like when it was a real civilization, you're looking at Ethiopia. Even in the 80s, it was so behind everyone else, but that was the beauty of it. You know, when you walked into Markato, the market there, it's the biggest landscape of goods that you'll come across, and it's still very much the authentic, you know, where there's medicines and it's molds of, you know, natural medicines or food like grains and things. It's very much a trade center, but very rooted in nature and in sort of their pride, because they don't know anything else.
Right.
So even their dress, I mean, they wear the most lush handmade cotton.
Oh, really?
Yeah, even in the rain, even in the winter, you know, the men wear these beautiful raw cotton, white as white blankets on themselves. And you see the people in the markets weaving the cotton and making it into threads and then weaving the actual natala, which is the thing they wear. And the women.
Really? Oh, yes. I mean, this we know. That some of the most magnificent women in the world.
Ooh, the women. The women.
Yeah, look. Yeah.
The women and what they wear and, you know, and how the food. They have like 300 and over 360 dishes with grains, ancient grains that, you know, it's not just like a variation of dal. It's like so many different grains and so many different sort of recipes and
oh, I feel like this needs to be my next trip. I feel like this needs. My mom gifted me a she came across a cross, which is like a key. It looks like a key. So each individual key or cross that is made in its own mold, they break the mold after they make these keys. And these are the crosses that are hung in in the Ethiopian
Lalibela
churches.
Yeah. Yes. Lalibela. And
Lalibela.
Yeah. Lalibela is the place that became very much Christian to Orthodox, yes. as it were. And that's the place that that some assume the arch, is that what it's called?
The Ark of the Covenant.
Yeah, is. And the churches are built of stone that is carved of rocks, like of the actual rocks on in the earth. And the monasteries and so on.
And they've got black angels. That was what was so interesting. The angels are black on the
all
paintings.
Their art is them. Right. It's not based on any European or any other, you know.
Right.
All the art is of them and their big eyes and, you know, some of the abstract art is pretty much speaks of themselves and their belief systems, even within, you know, say, an Orthodox context.
Right.
Yeah. And of course, then I realized afterwards that I have links to Makeda, who's the queen of Sheba.
Okay.
And in a past lifetime, the one who fell in love with King Solomon,
right.
of the Jews and brought back the Orthodox Jews brought back the religion to her own people.
Right.
Hence you now have the Orthodox Jews.
Right.
I don't know if you heard of them that went to Israel and that were rejected, etc. That's history. And then I've never been to Egypt, but I have a history with Nefertiti, and so are the people of Elangen, my grandmother's people. So it's as if, you know, we very much are removed from the idea that spiritual history is still very much active in our current lives, that we, you know, either by our own choice or instigated by those that guide us, we need to, you know, pay pilgrimage to some of the places that we've been to in past lifetimes or that our ancestors have been to. And that is a desire and a wish for some of them, especially those that end up migrating places, dying there, but their original places are elsewhere and they need to be repatriated. I had to do that for my father's ancestors who were missionaries in Eshowe, in KZN.
Right.
They were from the Williamson. My father's grandfather was a Williamson, and the whole lineage.
I've been to Eshowe, and I've seen those
the churches. Yes. So one of the paintings on the walls in one of the churches in Eshowe is of my great grandfather who was a bishop there. I only discovered that though as you know as much as an adult, because my father's family were pretty much Zulus. You know, they were just those coloreds who didn't know anything about their white families, but they knew that they were mixed, but they just lived as Zulus and never really bothered to connect to the white ancestors or family members who were in the same, you know, same town as them. So anyway, I did end up having to go back, travel to Scotland, to Fort Williams, where their king came from, King William. Mm-hmm. And then I ended up in Germany in King Wilhelm's church.
Oh, wow.
Because he was also there. And the weird thing about that is I spent 3 days in that in Berlin, where the church, the broken church is. Mm. And I never bothered to go into the church until on the third day. I was just going there to the internet cafe and hanging out. But this one day I entered the church, and apparently King William or Wilhelm, the church was burnt down, and he reconstructed the portion that was burnt down. But there's an old turret side that was still kind of how it was before. And so you go into the church, and there's church benches. It's a new area, renovated. And then you can go into the older part. So I went and did the candle thing of lighting the candles and whatever. Then I went to my spirit was drawn to that door there, and I went through it. And on the walls, I kid you not, the people on the walls, which was the family of the king, they just looked ordinary. They didn't look like, you know, Queen Victoria.
Right.
And they looked ordinary, dressed, you know, in very humble clothing. Their eyes were exactly my father's family eyes.
Wow.
And you just stare. You just go, oh, my God.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. How does this work? I mean, it's a small world.
Yes.
It's a small world. I wish we had more time with you. We haven't even gotten to any of the segments. Our show is actually maxed out now. We're finished. We do a 45-minute show. We didn't even get into any of the games. We're gonna have to have you back.
All right,
we're definitely gonna have to have you back. I hope that you learned something about yourself while watching this. I mean, that was very interesting for me.
Good. It was interesting for me too.
Oh, I'm so glad. Yeah. I think there's so much that I could learn from you, and I'm sure that we could all learn from you. So thank you so much for sharing your knowledge with us.
Thank you for teaching me as well. I learned a lot about Croatia.
Mm.
I learned a lot about Serbia. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot to learn about each other. And I think my ultimate fascination at the end of the day is with people.
Yeah.
I'm so fascinated with people, and we're all so similar. Mm. At the end of the day, we're just so similar. And at the essence of who we are, we're going through the same things. We're going through the same fears, the same anxieties, the same sense of the, you know, desire to belong, or the sense of being validated. And at the, you know, if you strip away all of that stuff, we're all just experiencing the same thing. So to categorize ourselves is so, it just gets in the way. Mm. It just gets in the way. It's standing in the way of you loving yourself. So I think that's truly what you've brought home. So thank you very much. Thank you so much. Thank you. Otherwise, you're well.